We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 131.
On today's show, we talk about Neanderthal art, a Nubian cathedral, and the Temple of the Winged Lions.
Let's dig a little deeper and do it artistically. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. Rachel, how you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Good, good. Day before you... Start your four-day rotation.
Yep, our recording schedule has me finishing my weekend by,
by recording. Weekend.
My three-day weekend. Yeah, that's true. So. That's true.
Anyway, we are out in the field. You might hear some rippling sounds of the little tent that we're in, the like easy up kind of thing, because we're outside and it's nice, and you're just going to hear some ambient noises probably. So
This is life in the field.
Life in the field.
You know, like we're real field archaeologists. Well, yeah. I am. I don't know about you. But.
Hey, I'm managing this project. I'm a PI on this project. So anyway, we have a guest, and if you're a fan of the Archaeotech podcast, you've already heard us in the field once, but Paul Zimmerman, my co-host on the Archaeotech podcast, is working with us on this project. I'm staring at his tent and his amazing camp set up right now. Paul, how's it going?
The camp has not fallen over yet, so I think I'm doing all right.
Pretty good.
This wind out here is something else. I wasn't prepared for it.
Yep.
Any day when one of your three tents doesn't fall over
is a good day.
Yeah, I did see your one tent was down earlier. Did you do that or
yeah,
did the wind take
purpose.
It down?
That awning thing, when I'm not there, I don't want it to rip it.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
Starting to get ahead of the curve a little bit on the.
Yeah, I think I've figured everything out with this. And I spent my weekend shoring everything up. I bought a whole bunch of stakes, actually spikes, at the farm store and spiked everything down heavily.
There you go.
There you go. So, yeah, it's constantly windy out here. And when it's not windy, it's just like, it's not too hot, I don't think, compared to some places, but man, it just gets stagnant.
Yeah.
And then the wind kicks up, though.
Yeah, so. We're at a pretty high elevation, so it's just it just feels hotter up here.
So. The air's a little thin.
Yeah, indeed.
Yep. Well, we have got a few articles to talk about today, and Paul's going to join us on that, of course, so let's get right to it. This first one is called A 51,000-Year-Old Carved Bone is One of the World's Oldest Works of Art. Actually, that's the NBC News article title. The actual Nature, Ecology, and Evolution article is A 51,000-year-old engraved bone reveals Neanderthals' a capacity for symbolic behavior by Derek Leder et al. And it was released in 2021. Actually, I think it was just July. July 5th, it says here. So you can find that. I'm pretty sure... Yeah, you can't get the whole article. I can't even get the whole article, so don't worry about that.
It's paywalled.
Yeah, it's paywalled. It says you can get it for $8.99, which is kind of nice. You don't have to get, like... a whole subscription if you don't want to. Anyway, you can see the abstract.
And the NBC article is pretty good.
Yeah, the NBC article is good, and I think there's an Apple News article. I can't remember how
it was NBC.
That took us to the same one.
Okay. So anyway, let's talk about it. The interesting thing about this is, let's just say what it is it's a... They know it's a deer bone and it's been carved, and it's got some like incised lines that are like chevrons. Depending on how you orient this, which we'll talk about that here in a minute, but if you orient it the way that it kind of stands up with the rounded end on top, it stands up on its own and the chevrons are kind of pointed up, if you will.
And that's the way it's oriented, like away from the body too, you know?
Yeah.
So it like points
away. Oh, like
away
the actual bone?
Yeah, I think, I believe it does.
I think so.
Yeah.
I forgot to check that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... They're saying this was dated to, again, 51,000 years ago. It's the world's oldest work of, quote, art. We'll talk about that in a minute. I want to talk about just like, you know, where it was found and all that stuff, and then we'll talk about the artifact here in a minute. Found in a cave in the Harz Mountains of central Germany. Let's see.
Einhornhöhle.
Yeah. It was radiocarbon dated. The cave is also called, I thought this was interesting, Unicorn Cave.
Yeah.
That's the translation. Famous since the 1600s. And it says fossilized bones thought to be unicorns were ground up to make medicine. So basically they were taking stegosaurs that are now rocks and making medicine.
I'm sure that worked.
Also some other info. This cave has been, you know, periodically inhabited for the last 130,000 years. Homo sapiens are detected from about 12,000 years ago, so Neanderthals up until then, possibly something else before Neanderthals, although that is within their date range. So, but what I'm more interested in is your guys' opinions on this being art.
Okay, well, you're going to have to define the word art.
Well, see, that's the whole problem, isn't it?
It is the whole problem.
How do you define the word art?
Okay, I've got a definition for the word art. Okay. It's a real waggish definition, but I stand by it and I've stood by it for years. And mind you, we talk about art a lot because my wife is an art historian.
Okay, that's right. Got it.
Something tells me what you're going to say is going to be very artful, but go ahead.
No. I have long since maintained that art is what people who are in a position to call something art call art. That there's nothing intrinsic about what's art versus decoration versus various kinds of human craft or whatever, mm-hmm. but it's that somebody that is in a position of power or authority that can say, yes, this is art, or no, this is not art. That's what makes it art.
So as soon as humans assign the word art to it, it becomes art.
Yes, and not just anybody, but
it has
somebody
to be like an important
of
person.
Some sort of authority to do so.
Okay.
That makes sense, and I've kind of got two definitions of art depending on perspective. My definition of art for myself and from the first person point of view is kind of anything that evokes an emotional response to me. That is art. Even if that emotional response is, that's not art, that's garbage. But also, it has to do with intent as well.
Yeah.
If somebody created it to be art, then it is art, whether you think it is or not.
Exactly.
I completely agree with that. I think that art is it's in the eye of the beholder, right? Like, if you think that it's art, then it is art.
Right. Now, when we're speaking archaeologically and we're looking at something 51,000 years old on a species of beings that no longer exists on this planet, calling this art or the oldest work of art is such a problem to me. We may see it as art because it's a work of art in nature by our ancestors, blah, blah, blah. But was the intent art? There's no way we can possibly know that.
Well, the intent is the important bit, I think, with why this particular piece is being called art, because this clearly was intentionally worked to look the way it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do these lines mean?
I don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
What they were saying is that this piece had to have been boiled, or most likely was boiled, in order to be carved, which meant that whoever was doing it wasn't just idly scratching lines into a bone that they happened to have from a kill earlier that day.
Well, that being said, though, if this truly was boiled in water,
it could have been their meal.
It could have been a meal, right?
It could have been.
Like the bone was. I mean, we never take into account just idle hands, right? And kids and stuff like that. So, you know, you got somebody cooking a meal, they're boiling it, and they pull out some bones because by then they would have realized, hey, this meat's really good when you boil it. So, you know, they pull out the bone because the meat just falls right off it, throw it down, it's still hot. And somebody just sits there and just idly starts doing stuff with it. And
that's how people learn how to do things.
But that's also art, when somebody's just kind of pecking away at something.
It can be.
You know, it can be.
Yeah.
Because if they're not making it for some other purpose, some other utilitarian purpose, then I guess they could have making it to be some, you know, not like, you know, masterpiece, but
Well, how many people do you know that are excellent doodlers?
Yeah, exactly. And that's art.
True.
It can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's art to them.
I mean, certainly a lot of Picassos got sold. I'm not talking about the paintings. I'm talking about the line drawings, which appear to me to be doodles.
They're squiggles, a lot of them. Yeah.
Right.
True. I don't know. I think that assigning the word art is a bit of a reach, and maybe a little bit of that like sensationalist attitude that the media can get sometimes around archaeology. Although I think that the actual guy who found it is the one who was first postulating that maybe it's early art, but you just can't know the intention, so it's very hard to say. And I also take a little bit of skepticism with the boiled part of it, because you can carve it. Like, we are out in the field seeing people who have carved into aspen trees, okay? You can carve into anything if you really want to. You don't need to boil it first. If you've got a sharp enough tool, you can make that happen.
Yeah, fresh bone can be pretty soft.
It can be.
You see incised lines, not unlike what's on this picture, for kill and processing sites.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
you do, yeah.
And just a point of reference out there, I mean, one of these markings I can see on here might just be a piece missing from the bone and not one of the incised lines, but it's very U-shaped. And I think we've talked about this before, but if you're looking at any bones that have been affected by either animals or humans on a site, one of the ways that you can tell that it was gnawed on versus cut with a tool is cut with a tool, they're V-shaped every single time because that's how tools are shaped and that's what you do. Going back even to this thing, I mean,
you create a sharp edge and it's V-shaped. Yeah. It just always is. Yeah.
But if you're gnawing on it with like your incisors or your teeth, it's going to be U-shaped. Yeah. That's how your teeth are shaped. Unless you're, you know, from the 80s and you're goth, then your teeth might be razor sharp. But who knows?
So, but then what you do is you look for the two prick marks on the neck of them.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but some things I had, I took issue with this, and this was, some of this was from the archaeologist that found it originally, and then for the people who wrote the paper is, you know, that quote that I wrote down was, it's clearly a decoration with a kind of symbolic character. You might even call it the initial start of art, which is just because it's the oldest doesn't mean it's the start.
Something and you don't know not, it's actually the oldest. Well, it's the oldest it's that art. We've found.
I know.
And I assume that that was the subtext of it. Yeah, I mean, I don't think any archaeologists.
Yeah, but when they write that stuff and then it gets put in NBC News, people take it that way.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know, so we need to start changing our language on that and not call it the oldest art or not call it the first art, but call it the oldest art, which admittedly the headline did that. But if you read the article, it's, you know, it, they're leading you to believe it's like the first art, which there's literally no way we could know that.
Right.
And I find that hard to believe. I mean, apes make art if you want to look at it that way. So, you know.
Well, oh, we're getting real skeptical on this article.
What I'm curious about, actually, the other thing that we haven't talked about yet was the context of it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that maybe argues for why this could have some sort of, whether you want to call it art or not, but some sort of symbolic importance, right?
Right.
And that's where I would have loved to have seen the actual article, because I want to see photographs and drawings of the context here. But they said that it was found alongside the shoulder blades, bones of a deer, and the intact skull of a cave bear. Okay, so the tight association of these three animal parts from different kinds of animals suggests that people put them there for a reason.
Yeah, true.
That comment was also placed alongside of these are rare objects, indicating the assemblage had possibly ritual meaning drink. Because ritual is the word for APN.
Sorry.
Not APN, TAS.
Actually, I think that Neanderthal might need to be our drink, too. I feel like we talk about Neanderthal stuff like every other week.
You guys are going to have alcohol poisoning if you do that.
I know, right? There's so much great stuff coming out about Neanderthals, though. So it's just...
Well, they lived for, you know, over 100,000 years in Europe.
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's actually another point I wanted to make. Why this is ascribed to Neanderthals and not anatomically modern humans.
I think it's because of the comment I made earlier. We're not seeing the whole picture of this, but they've got clear presence of humans, or sort of they're saying Homo sapiens, around 12,000 years ago. And I don't know if that's from actual, you know, skeletal evidence or not.
Yeah. And so, my understanding, it wasn't until around 35,000 years ago or thereabouts that that modern humans went into Central Europe like that. So this predates to
assume
that's the assumption. That's why it's human-like behavior, it had to have been Neanderthals rather than
Yeah, us. Something I thought was interesting too, and I wrote this down in the notes because they didn't mention it in the article, and maybe it's because of my lack of knowledge of symbology and how old this kind of stuff is, but some of the earliest symbolic representations of male and female are, you know, like a pointed up diamond is male and a pointed down one is female, or chevron. And if this is oriented the way they say it is, if that was the original intent, then it's pointed up indicating male. And to be honest, it does look a little phallic.
It does, yeah.
That bone
like
does.
The whole thing does.
Yeah.
But who knows? I don't really know what this was. It's really cool. I like that it's, I mean, some things we can say pretty clearly is this is neat. It was made by humans or human ancestors, so Neanderthals, and it was done intentionally.
Yeah.
You know, these aren't the kind of marks you would make when you're cutting the meat off the bone.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, this is definitely something that was done after that.
I wonder. Yeah.
And more patterned.
Yeah.
One more question about it. Have they done any like microscopic analysis that could say like if it was attached to some kind of cording or something for jewelry purposes maybe, or?
It's not pierced.
It's
not pierced.
The guy said it's clearly not a pendant or something like that, which is again, something I had objection connection to, because it could have been embedded within some sort of cordage.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. And we do know, as we talked about a few months back, that Neanderthals were making string. Yeah. So we know that they could have been doing some kind of something with that. But
The assumption, because it stands on one end, is that that's how it would have been displayed.
Yeah.
But you look at it and you certainly could wrap a loop around it a few times and tie it tight and turn it into a pendant.
True. Well, it just looks like it with the shape. Yeah. How it kind of comes in.
I wonder if you'd even have any fiber remnants or anything left at this point. Probably not, right?
But if you're going to find it, it's going to be in a cave.
True. Yeah,
especially in Europe. It's going to be a damp environment pretty much forever. So, but again, the article is really only talking about this piece, and we don't have the original Nature article to see what else was found there. So it's interesting. Anyway, I thought one other thing I remember, and I didn't write this down, but I remember it from the article, is I think the original archaeologist talking about how he imagined it, since you can stand it on its end and it will sit freely, that he imagined it just sitting in the corner of the cave, keeping watch or looking over or something. Like, come on. Seriously.
That's some reach right there.
Well, and, the thing is, when you get this back to the lab, or you're even in your field lab and you set it on the table and you're like, oh my God, it stands up. They didn't have tables 51,000 years ago. Okay. So something didn't have to have a base on it that was flat to make it stand. You could just dig it into the dirt a little bit. Yeah. Or you could set it on a rock, I guess. But
archaeologists find world's first table.
World's first table.
Change the headline. They got it all wrong.
AKA Big Rock. World's first table is 3 billion years old. You don't say, it's a rock. So anyway, that's where I think we're at here. And some of the researchers said that it looks like it looks female, like just the shape of it. Like maybe it was kind of shaped, although that looks somewhat natural to the bone shape to me.
Yeah.
And also that the lines look like mountains. I mean, you could ascribe anything to the shape of this, pareidolia, whatever your brain thinks of,
Straight line decoration is basically the easiest one to do. So you can assign any kind of meaning or reasons to that.
Yeah. The only thing that might lend some credence to some sort of symbolic thing or even ritual drink is, apparently this species of deer was really large and very rare for this area at that time. So we have enough knowledge. And that's another cool thing about bringing other sciences into archaeology. You almost always, you can't look at archaeology in a vacuum, as just a single science. Like with physics, you can almost just talk about physics, what I mean? Chemistry, you can probably just talk about chemistry, although at smaller levels, you're bringing in physics again. But archaeology, you're almost always bringing something else in.
Yeah.
Biology.
Ecology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Geology.
For sure.
Zoology. Yeah.
Gotta have that big picture.
So anyway, that's about it for this article. Tell us what you think in the show notes for this. You can go to arcpodnet.com/archaeology/131 and leave a comment, or wherever you found this episode. So next we're going to move over to the medieval Nubian Cathedral in Sudan. We'll be there in a second. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 131. And we are traveling south a bit.
And about 51,000 years into the future, too, right?
That is true. So this article was found, just like the last one was, by our... Actually, I think I found the last one. But this one was found by our new producer in a resource called the Art Newspaper, and we'll link to it. And the title is Archaeologists Find Ruins of Vast Medieval Nubian Cathedral in Sudan. So, talking about a Polish team using remote sensing techniques to detect the building, largest of its kind in the region, as well as a possible tomb of an archbishop. So, let's talk about that. Mm-hmm. So, this is found in what they call as Old Dongola, Northern Sudan. I'm probably going to pronounce all of this wrong. Largest Nubian church ever found in the region. It was a medieval cathedral, and these, in general, could have been the seat of the power for the archbishops in Nubian Kingdom of Makuria, where Christianity took hold in the mid-6th century. So Christianity, we're saying cathedral, we literally mean like a Christian cathedral,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it had taken over in this area by that time. So,
right, so that's where the bishop would have been.
Yeah,
exactly. The archbishop.
Presumably, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought this was pretty cool, though, because they found this through remote sensing, and its size was 26 meters wide with a 6 meter wide apse. And I had to look up an apse. And am I pronouncing it right? APSE?
Yeah, apse.
Apse. Yeah.
I thought I put the definition.
Not to be mistaken for an asp. Yeah. It'd be unfortunate finding a 6 meter long asp.
That would be
You don't want to
bad.
Find an asp in an apse. That would be bad.
No, that would be bad. There we go. I got the definition here. So excavation revealed two walls of the church's apse, which is a large semicircular or polygonal recess in a church with an arched or domed roof, typically at the eastern end, and contains the altar. Perhaps every Catholic or Christian listening to this knows what that is, but I had to look it up.
That's basically how most churches are set up.
Yeah,
they have something like that.
Yeah.
So, you heathen.
I know, right? So it's pretty cool because it was decorated with paintings depicting, it just says monumental figures. I would have liked to have known what those paintings were.
Yeah, definitely.
That would have been pretty neat.
Monumental figures of who?
Of religious figures or people of the time?
I would assume saints or something, right?
Yeah, probably a lot of Jesus, right?
I would assume.
Maybe. In a church?
Yeah.
I mean,
who knows?
Yeah.
Christianity was way different in medieval times than it is now, so you never know.
Yeah, and I know nothing about Christianity in Africa, but I don't know how closely it aligns with what we know of from Europe at the same time.
Yeah, true. So you said found by remote sensing. Do you know exactly what they meant by that?
I don't know that they mention it.
Okay.
I'm like, is it GPR?
Well, they
found a huge empty space in the center of a subterranean citadel. Mm-hmm. And
then I'm going to just that term, subterranean citadel, and there's the photograph on that art newspaper article that shows them digging on a slight hill overlooking a river.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is a subterranean citadel? That makes no sense whatsoever. So I chased the article back to the University of Warsaw press release.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's an English one. We ought to put the link in for that one because that one's much clearer. I think that what happened here is that this art newspaper one stuff was lost in translation.
Okay.
I think what they mean is buried citadel.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. That makes much more sense.
It's an archaeological site, and they show them digging down through soil like you've seen in any of a zillion different archaeological sites.
Because it turns out archaeology is buried.
Yeah,
well, not
often.
Out here, but like mostly buried.
Yeah, quite frequently.
Yeah.
Well, and it looks like what we're seeing in the picture, too, is the excavated apse of the cathedral.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's that curved wall there.
So the citadel itself, and I don't know if it was mentioned in this one, but it's definitely mentioned in the University of Warsaw press release, is a walled citadel. So it's a nice urban unit at least I'm used to thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that they were expecting to find a plaza in the middle of it.
Okay.
And then they came down and instead they found honkin' big church.
Right.
Cathedral.
Yeah.
And they also compared it to another cathedral at another site in the area called Faros that had the same sort of layout. This is a much larger one than the one at Faros. So it's the cathedral and also a shrine of types with a domed building right next to it that would have been the tombs for the bishops and probably other church dignitaries.
Gotcha.
And so that it comports with this one that's been known for 60 plus years. that's how they identified what this is within the city. And then also being within the citadel, a walled citadel, suddenly it all starts to make sense. But that right. subterranean citadel just broke my brain for a
poor
bit.
Poor word choice for sure.
Yeah, for sure. One thing I thought they mentioned I thought was interesting was they said medieval churches were significant landowners, which is not the interesting part. That's pretty well known.
Mm-hmm. Still true.
Yeah. And the backbone of society, they were the backbone of society and often run by members of elite or royal families. I mean, what does that mean? The church is run by elite or royal families when is it not run by the church? Or the archbishop?
Oh, there's just a lot of mixing back and forth.
But is it really run by those elite families, or are they just influenced heavily?
Well, run might be not quite the right word, but
yeah,
I don't know though, because like a lot of times when you had a family that had many children, the second, third, fourth, fifth son or whatever would go into the church and then become an archbishop, and then that church is tied to the family, and then all of a sudden it is kind of a family run church. Business that happened a lot, so could be like that.
That's what I suspect they mean.
Yeah,
that's how I took it because that conforms with what I know about European relations between kingdoms and the church.
Yep, you know? Definitely.
Okay. All right. Well, not a whole lot else to say on this. Go ahead and read the article. I'll try to get that link from Paul, and we'll link to the original article from the University of Warsaw. One thing I will mention is Dongola, this area, flourished as a Christian center, it says, until the 14th century, when, of course, Islam gained ascendancy after that.
Yeah, that was the big question I had, is because I didn't really realize that there would have been that many Christian centers in Sudan. That was surprising to me to hear. So I didn't get a chance to like delve deep into the history of it and how they got there. I'm guessing the Crusades played a part.
I was
going to
say, isn't the Crusades pretty much responsible for the spread of Christianity to areas like this?
Probably
yeah.
To some extent.
Yeah, but
again, I don't know Africa.
Yeah, I don't know that history too well, but it would be interesting to figure out like when they came there and how and why. So,
I was frankly surprised that it's not till the 14th century that Islam.
Yeah,
a foothold there. I thought that Islam spread to the Sudan with the original conquest,
And maybe it did, and then Christianity came in.
It's possible.
And then Islam took back over later.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. It's also possible they're side by side for a while because that happens.
More likely too, right?
Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
A fly just drowned in my beer.
That's gross.
Smart
I'm pretty upset
fly.
About that.
Yeah, wait, put lids on it.
I don't like lids. Sorry, all right. Derailed. I kind of can't believe that just happened.
I know. Well, anyway, I was, again, disappointed that we didn't get to see what the decorated paintings and monumental figures were. So instead, maybe we'll just talk about some winged lions.
Before we get to... Oh, that's good.
Oh, transition. Transition.
I'm not even going to say what I'm going to say because that's just too good.
Oh, would we say good?
Is it a transition if you call it out? I don't know. You just got to let it happen.
I'm never going to let you just transition.
All right. So let's end this segment now. Again, go check out the show notes if you want to read the articles. And we're going to go...
And west.
We're going to go to a
north
different part of Africa.
And west. No, and not even Africa.
Not even Africa. And we're going to go...
Hey, geography. You want to be on Jeopardy?
I didn't think about it. All right. And we're going to go west to Petra, a pretty well-known site, and talk about the Temple of the Winged Lions back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 131, and we are headed to Petra and the Temple of the Winged Lions, which is probably the best name of anything I've ever heard.
Pretty cool.
On this show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a good name.
Yeah.
It's a cool site.
Yeah.
Petra and the temple. And
yeah.
Everything around there.
Have you been there?
Yeah. Funny you should ask.
What?
Yeah, as opposed to, you know, the Sudan, which I know very little about. Jordan, I know a thing or two about. And Petra, I know, a thing or two or three about.
Mm-hmm. Hallucinating while watching Indiana Jones doesn't count.
I'm not hallucinating while sitting where that. Oh wait, no, that's, let's not talk about that.
Let's not talk about that. Yeah, so you've been there. I was pretty excited to have you here. I just this article was found again by our producer, not knowing you knew anything about Petra. So I thought this would be a good one to have you for. So
right. So okay. So here was my transition that I was thinking about from the last one. Really cool thing about that. Cathedrals, they said that they found walls preserved up to three stories high. Now, not that it was a three-story tall building, but that the walls would have been sufficient to have three stories, which is quite a bit of deposition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for freestanding structure, that's pretty amazing. And Temple of the Winged Lions, now, for anybody that knows anything about Petra, you normally think about the rock-cut tombs into the cliffs, but it's an urban center.
Okay.
And so there are a lot of freestanding buildings across the hills and all around that area.
Okay.
And the Temple of the Winged Lions being one of these. And this one was excavated from the early 70s until the early 2000s by, I believe it was University of Utah, the American Expedition to Petra.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was called Temple of the Winged Lions because they found column capitals with, wait for it,
what could possibly have been on top?
What was it?
And, you know, wait, here's an aside. So we excavated the Petra Great Temple, which is literally across the street, across the wadi from the Temple of the Winged Lions.
Yeah.
Okay.
So every day from our site, we could look right across the wadi, across the ancient street down below at the Temple of the Winged Lions on the hill across the way.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Our temple, they found elephant head capitals.
Okay.
Hmm. But we became the Petra Great Temple, not the Temple of the Elephant Heads.
Well, I think you should rename it because Temple of the Elephant Heads is way cooler.
That's super cool.
Yeah. But this project, anyhow, who's the principal on it? I don't know him, but he's currently a fellow at ACOR, the American Center of Research. It recently used to be the American Center for Oriental Research, but thankfully they managed to drop
that word. That's good
highly
choice.
Problematic.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Not a great word.
Let's see. I'm just quickly looking at the show notes here. I don't have his name, but he did.
Philip C. Hammond?
No, that was the original excavator.
Oh, okay.
The person who wrote this article is Marco Denner.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's actually called, if you're looking for it and don't want to use our show notes, A Journey from the Excavation Archive Back to the Site, The Architectural Decoration of the Temple of the Winged Lions, Petra. And again, this is on the ACOR website, the American Center of Research, and just on their publication site. You know, a little bit of background. I mean, he's been studying this area, but this particular research, he basically got to spend essentially the winter there, you know, and since a lot of people are in lockdown still over the winter, especially over there, basically had the place to himself and was basically doing a kind of a double check on measurements and recordings, architectural features that had already been done over the last few decades there, and looking at that database and updating it, and then recording additional things from what I can take.
Yeah, so this wasn't new research, you know, and this is actually a really great thing that needs to be done in a lot of phases of archaeology now, is looking back at old records, reinterpreting them, reevaluating them. And so he was forced for a while to do just archival research, but then had the opportunity for an extended period of time to go out into the field and groundproof the archival research, which is really cool. It's nice that he was able to do that. He was trying to find, you know, like individual architectural elements, pieces that were put together. These freestanding buildings are generally built out of the surrounding sandstone.
Okay.
Same stuff that those rock-cut facades are into, quarried and then piled up. Now, sandstone is really soft, and over time it degrades and falls apart, and the area is subject to earthquakes. But what had happened with the excavations is that they pulled the blocks as they removed them, and they piled them off on a flat area next to the temple. In this article, they're referred to as lapidaria. You know, we always just call them the lapidaries. And basically, it's stacked rocks from the excavation.
Oh, nice.
Right? Okay.
Some of them are labeled, some aren't. Some are measured. Some in the notes from the original excavations are said they're in lapidary one or two or whatever, and others weren't. So he was trying to verify what could still be identified, what couldn't, what condition things were in.
Right.
You know. So it's interesting to me. It's a study of old archaeological practices and recording, but then it's also you can look at it as kind of a meta project. You know, what did he find with this? What happened to the things that went missing? Why would they have been missing? What was wrong with the original recording? What recording did he do? Is he going to make this available in what format for various people going forward? So it's interesting to me because we did many of those same practices at the Great Temple that were done at the Temple of the Winged Lions. Now, I'd like to think that we did it better, but I know that, you know, 20, 30 years from now, somebody's going to come by and complain about the notes that I failed to take well.
Well, that's what always happens. And we're experiencing this here in Nevada on our project. Mm. Like, we're going to these previously recorded sites, and some of them were recorded in the 80s and 90s. And the information that they recorded at that time is less and not as detailed as what we record now.
Right.
So it's just, I think it's true of all archaeology. It's an evolving science. Mm-hmm. And what we did 20, 30, 40 years ago is different than now. And I hate to say it, but it's kind of less sufficient, right? Like, we're just doing more now, it seems like. Maybe it's because we know more. We have more technology. We're just doing more.
Yeah.
From a CRM standpoint, it could be just different and possibly more amounts of money and resources and ability and time to go out and do that.
True.
Well, I think time is a big part because we have so many, you know, you talk about this all the time on the Architect podcast, but using the newer tools that we have in order to record more and record better and record more accurately. And so he does use some tech whiz bangery.
He does some. He definitely does some photogrammetry.
Whiz bangery. That's like, that,
like
word.
That word.
That's a good word. I like that.
It doesn't say what methods he used for this. Probably just a camera, to be honest. But he uses what's called structure for motion. Mm-hmm. You know, basically taking lots of pictures, photogrammetry.
Yeah.
To produce 3D representations of these things. Mm. So that's pretty cool.
The example that they have in the article is, it looks to me like it's probably from a drone because it's a slightly overhead shot of one of the lapidaries, and you can see all the rocks stacked and kind of neatly organized there.
Yeah.
And
that's
if
cool.
you didn't know that that's what you're looking at, you might think that you're looking at architecture. What you're actually looking at is the detritus of the archaeologists who pulled apart architecture that collapsed.
Destructive science. Like it is, and you have to do something with that. So
he definitely has some either drone or kite footage here that he used to make the 3D models, because that's, you know, some of these overhead shots, you would have had to have done that.
I mean, there's a lot of relief there. The hills are very steep, so you could climb up to the ridge above and take some good pictures down onto the Temple of the Winged Lions.
Okay.
But I don't think he'd be able to get that kind of detail. I don't think he'd be able to get enough photographs to do any kind of decent structure for motion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, especially all the way around.
Right. So this says, in the article, he says that this temple specifically was built first century AD. Uh-huh. They said it was one of the most important buildings within the city center of Petra. Not going to address that too much, but I'm curious, do you know, because I don't know a whole lot about the building of Petra and occupation of Petra. Do you know where that lies within the habitation of Petra and, you know?
Yeah. So Petra is the capital, or at least the main city, of the Nabataeans. The Nabataeans were a nomadic Arab tribe in the area of northwestern Saudi Arabia, the Negev, and southern Jordan. Mm-hmm. And they came to control that end of the spice and incense trade, you know, coming up from Yemen, frankincense and myrrh.
Mm-hmm.
Yemen. Every time I say Yemen, I should drink. and then by the first century BC, they consolidated and started settling into cities, Petra being the major one. There are a number of other sites that share things, like Madain Saleh in Saudi is another very big rock cut facade tomb type site. I don't know what there is for urban architecture there, but I would expect there's a city there as well.
Okay.
And there are a number of other ones in the Negev and around Jordan. Anyhow, they consolidated their power and they became the major power brokers controlling all that nexus of these trade routes, right? Mm-hmm. So they controlled all the way out to Gaza, all the way out to the Mediterranean. And the incense was really highly prized by Romans. And Egyptians, but Rome is the perspective that we generally look at it from. And then in 106 AD, the Nabataean kingdom, which was allied with Rome, was annexed by Rome, so under Trajan.
Oh.
But it still was the major city. Petra was the major city of Arabia Petraea, of this province of Rome, and continued to be occupied and continued to be Nabataean in character up until the middle of the 4th century AD, when it got hit by a very big earthquake or a series of very big earthquakes.
Oh, okay.
But it didn't disappear then.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So we were just talking about a medieval church. Well, they have their own Byzantine church just, you know, a couple hundred meters, you know, if even that, away from the Temple of the Winged Lions on the same hillside.
Yeah.
Big church in the 90s when it was discovered, there was found carbonized scrolls
that
have records of families and land and all these things that we were just talking about. And they also found really elaborate mosaics in there. So it persisted as a city, as a major center. This was still the bishopric through the Byzantine period, and then eventually fell into disuse. And then by the time of its discovery in the 17th century, that is discovery by a European for Europeans to know about.
Right.
That's how discovery works.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, the people, the Bedouin who lived there ever since and probably preceding, they were pretty sure that it was there. Generations upon generations of them growing up in the caves and the and in amongst the site.
Well, things like the, I don't even know what the actual name of it is, but the classic Indiana Jones, you know.
Yeah, that's the Khazna. That's,
yeah.
So there are a couple different entrances to the city, but the main one, the one that you would have been funneled through if you were bringing in goods, for example, is called the Seek. And it's this really narrow cleft. It goes down to just a few meters wide. And then at the end of it, very dramatically, there's an opening. And that's where that Indiana Jones.
Oh,
but stuff like that was never completely buried in sand, right? I mean, that would have been visible like that
for a
long time.
Been visible for quite a while.
So these, I mean, people that have lived in this area, like you said, it's never been gone. It's never been disappeared. If you'd asked them 600 years ago, they'd be like, oh, yeah, it's over there.
Absolutely. And so the Temple of the Winged Lions, being a freestanding building, got destroyed in an earthquake, as did the Great Temple.
Okay.
And so basically there are two large freestanding structures in the center city proper that didn't get totally wiped out by earthquakes. And that's Khazar al-Bint, which is still standing, huge walls, at least three stories tall, if it had stories, which is probably another temple. And then there's also a triumphal arch right at the end of the street as you get down to the very bottom, just before you get to the Khazar al-Bint.
And that's it? Everything else was destroyed by earthquakes or time, basically?
Earthquakes, time, and the fact that they use sandstone.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sandstone. Right. Can't forget that.
So where did everybody go? Like, why didn't some cities experience earthquakes and are just rebuilt over time because they're in really important areas? Was this just, did they realize, hey, middle of the desert's not the best place to put a city?
Yeah, and it's complicated because there's having water for an urban center is, so the whole place is littered with dams and cisterns and water channels and such. But maintenance of that is really problematic.
I can imagine.
Right? So you have to have people that know what they're doing and enough people that can do it and keep the upkeep. The main mercantile centers moved farther north in the Roman period. And so it just eventually kind of fell off the map. Ghost town wise, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Sounds like a really cool area. Now I want to travel again so that we can start going to cool places like that.
I know. Unfortunately, though, like, and you can probably speak to this, Paul, but I mean, for some reason, just recently, I looked up, I feel like if you want to get a sense of what tourism is like in some areas, Instagram's a really good way to do that. Because if you just put in a hashtag Petra or something like that, you see the typical, you know, the typical view that everybody gets.
Yep,
and
yep.
sometimes people will get, you know, they'll get up on the hillside or they'll get a nice shot of it, you know, just empty. In fact, I think we were watching Indiana Jones a few months ago. And
like we do
and
as one
and,
does
right and I wanted to know what the inside of it looked like because obviously in the movie they go in and it's a whole thing I wanted to know what the inside of it looks like, which is basically almost nothing, a few chambers.
I can show you pictures. Large empty chambers. Some of them have niches cut into them for like coffins or something, but they may be later additions because almost all of these were lived in by Bedouin subsequently and they've been modified to service houses.
Yeah.
You know, well, which is cool. I mean, archaeology is a living thing. You know, we have this notion of, this untouched for centuries ancient city. But the people who live there live in and amongst it. Yeah. And it's part of their lives and their memories and their traditions. And yeah, it doesn't mean that it's this pristine thing that got encased in amber. It has its own history.
That's interesting because I never really thought about it that way. But I feel like archaeologists, we collectively as a whole around the world for the last 140 years or so that we've had the term archaeologist and the profession, we're the ones that cause it to stop.
Yeah.
Because we get there and we're like, okay, we need to preserve this.
Yeah.
Everybody stop. We're going to start digging now. But the people who live there and around there are like, yeah, I guess we're not going there anymore.
Yeah, well, without getting too far on a tangent here, if you look at Palmyra in the early 20th century, it was a thriving village called Tadmor.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And the French emptied it out because they wanted an archaeological park. And so there are aerial photos of this going from this messy mud brick village with bits of columns and stuff sticking out of it to this pristine white.
Really.
I mean, I could put a link in there. There's some great work done by Michael Press in Hyperallergic about that. So maybe we ought to just put that link.
When did they do that? Did you say?
I want to say it was in the 1920s and 1930s. Maybe it was all in the 1930s. But anyhow, it's a pre-war, interwar period.
Makes sense for the time period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's because it didn't conform to their idea of what archaeology should be.
Yeah. Interesting.
And the people who lived there be damned.
Yeah.
Well, what I was mentioning about Instagram was, you know, you get a good sense of the crowds that you can see at these places because a lot of people, they don't wait or they're impatient and they don't filter and they just pop whatever the picture they just took up on Instagram, which is actually kind of handy because when I looked at Petra, I hate people so much. And I was just like looking at it and it's just crowds and crowds of people. And I mean, you guys are cool, but people in general, I just like, no, and our audience is cool too, but no, my point is, you know, you go to these places.
You're like, supposed to tell people that you hate people.
We follow a bunch of like RV channels too, because we're RVers now. And I see these people posting about, on Instagram usually, about like Zion's hot right now, you know, because people haven't been able to get out. The park's fully open. And you see these people walking this one popular hike and it's just like, hundreds of them like jammed into this one little area when we were in Yosemite.
Yeah,
a couple of years ago. And
I'm sure Yosemite's like that right now too.
Oh, Yosemite, Yellowstone, they're all a nightmare, right? Yeah. So any one of these places, man, I really want to go, but I'm like, man, that's halfway around the world, so I can just go crowd around with a bunch of other people. But still, sounds like it's still amazing to see regardless. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to give one bit of advice I've given to people forever. A lot of people that go to see Petra come up from Israel for a day. And they come in on a bus and they go out on a bus. They spend very little time there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they try to see as much as they can. And their memory of it is being harassed by Bedouin, for pictures or for camel rides and whatnot. And being extremely hot and tired trying to do it. Mm-hmm. And the proper way to do it is take 2 to 3 days, live in Wadi Musa, the town just up the hill from it, in one of the hotels. They've got beautiful hotels if you want. And space it out because it is a humongous urban center. And the more you walk over it, the more you see. And then you don't have that time crunch and you can explore it and not wear yourself out. And it makes such a huge difference.
Nice.
That is good advice for any big archaeological site because we found the same thing with Chichen Itza when we were in Mexico. We were corralled through that place in like an hour and a half, 90 minutes. We were told from the beginning 90 minutes was all we got. And like, I feel like I could have spent all day, probably 2 days there. So I would say, well, tours are great and you do want a local probably to tell you about things.
Mm-hmm. Like the first time.
Yeah. But like, just make sure that you're not being rushed through any site that you are interested in and want to learn about and spend time at.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
Very good advice.
I think we should just take Paul with us next time we go.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take Paul.
So my friends are still there.
Nice. All right. Well, Paul, it's been great to have you on the show.
It's been fun.
We do this weekly, so, There's a chance. We might do this again, yeah. So we got at least a few more weeks out here.
Yep.
If you got any comments or anything on any of these articles, again, arcpodnet.com/archaeology/131 or wherever you saw this show. Don't comment on like iTunes or anything because we don't go over there too much. But Facebook, Twitter,
Well, if
Instagram,
you go to iTunes,
we're there.
Give us 5-star reviews.
Absolutely, oh, yeah. Give us a review.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, only 5-star reviews.
Only.
Reviews.
Yeah, if you give us a 1-star review, also email Tristan at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and tell him why.
Yes.
So
sounds good.
Yeah.
You say that like he won't just forward it immediately to you.
I know, that's right. That's right. All right, thanks, guys, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to come in and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.